Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, paying our way to peace in Afghanistan. Some say the moment for military might has passed. It's time, they say, to use good intelligence and a lot of green to win the war on terror. First, who will lead New York City after Rudy Giuliani is gone? Tomorrow, New Yorkers go to the polls. Despite the city's unity after the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center, the battle between Democrat Mark Green and Republican Michael Bloomberg has been bitter. I spoke earlier with WNYC political reporter Beth Fertig and asked her if the election is still too close to call.
Today, a new poll showed Mike Bloomberg and Mark Green running neck and neck with 42% each of the electorate and about 15% undecided, which is a huge number. So both candidates really see a lot of voters being up for grabs, and right now they're basically throwing everything they can at each other in order to try to move the votes their way.
This was supposed to be a cakewalk for the Democrats. It hasn't turned out that way. Why not?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. The first is I think it's fair to say that Mark Green, who's the elected public advocate, he's kind of a citywide ombudsman, he's been in government a long time, and I think that he really took his opponent for granted. He didn't really expect that this unknown businessman could get within shooting distance of him. But second of all, Mark Green emerged from a Democratic primary that was very racially divided. He narrowly defeated the Bronx Borough President Fernando Ferrer, who was hoping to become the first Latino mayor and had huge support in the Black and Latino community. At the end of that election, there was an ad that some voters considered a racial type of assault on Fernando Ferrer, and there were flyers that went out in communities linking Fernando Ferrer to the Reverend Al Sharpton, calling him the Reverend Sharpton's puppet or saying that you would be giving Reverend Sharpton the keys to City Hall. And so some voters complained about these tactics. Mr. Green said his campaign had nothing to do with it, but it left, I think, a sour feeling among a lot of loyal Democrats. And lastly, you have to look at how much money Mr. Bloomberg is spending. He spent over $40 million as of the end of October on his campaign. There's estimates that it'll be $50 or $60 million by the end of this, four or five times as much as Mark Green. His ads are saturating the airwaves. The latest one features an endorsement by Rudolph Giuliani, who's very, very popular right now, the incumbent mayor. So all of these factors, I think, have really influenced the electorate to start thinking about a Republican businessman at a time when the city's economy is in turmoil as an alternative to the Democrat.
How are these two candidates coming across to New Yorkers? What images have set in for Democrat Mark Green and Republican Michael Bloomberg at this point? How are they perceived?
At this point, with both of them running so many negative ads, I'm not sure that many voters love either of them. I mean, that's probably the fallout of all this negative campaigning. You talk to voters and they say they're not too excited about either of them. Voters who are choosing Michael Bloomberg at this point say that they respect him as a businessman. They think because, as I said, the economy is doing so badly after the attack on the World Trade Center, we lost so many jobs. They think this is the type of experience that he will need. Voters who support Mark Green say primarily if they're Democrats, they say we don't want a Republican running City Hall again, or they say that we don't want somebody with no experience in government. Mark Green has been around government for a long time, and also as a civil rights type of advocate, a civil rights lawyer, they think that his experience is going to be useful in City Hall. But I think you've got two men who are basically both liberals. Michael Bloomberg was a liberal Democrat before switching parties at the end of last year. So in terms of government philosophy, perhaps, they're really not that far apart.
Yesterday's cover story of the New York Times Magazine had this caption. It said, "No mayor of New York has ever assumed a job as difficult as this one has suddenly become." Sir Rudy Giuliani is a tough act to follow, isn't he?
Definitely a very tough act to follow, and that's been a topic of this campaign is, you know, at first it was a bunch of Democrats running to be the anti-Giuliani, saying they wanted to keep the best of Giuliani while not including some of the things that had alienated a lot of voters, particularly the relationship between the police and the minority community that Giuliani was criticized for. But ever since September 11th, the mayor's been basking in the glow of, you know, being America's mayor. And so that makes it very, very hard. And so Michael Bloomberg has just been trumpeting this endorsement by Rudolph Giuliani in all of these television ads, just clinging to Giuliani as I'm the guy who can succeed him. And I think that certainly helped him in the polls lately. While Mark Green, who for many years was critical of Rudolph Giuliani, suing him over his failure to release disciplinary records against the police, being very critical of his leadership style, Mark Green is now campaigning with Rudolph Giuliani's first police commissioner, William Bratton, and boasting that he's the person who knows more about lowering crime. He's been endorsed by all of the law enforcement unions, which is very interesting for a Democrat. The police, the firefighters, the EMS workers have all endorsed Mark Green. So he's trying to portray himself now as the moderate Democrat who's kind of mixing all the best lessons of Rudolph Giuliani's tenure with his own career as an activist.
Beth, what is the mood in New York right now about the changing of the political guard in the middle of this crisis we've been in? With everything that's happened in the city, is there a sense of unusual anxiety about bringing in a new mayor now?
I think so, and I think that's why the polls show so many undecided voters. I think people are not thinking about the mayor's race, or really weren't until the last minute. They were thinking more about, you know, people who they know who may have died, the tremendous loss of jobs, the fact that there's, you know, a gaping hole in southern Manhattan right now where the Twin Towers used to stand. These are the things that are on their minds, along with the latest anthrax scares. They're worrying every time a subway stops if there's going to be some, you know, biochemical attack in a subway station. They're not thinking about politics. And when you ask them, they say, God, I'm just not focusing. I haven't thought about it. On the other hand, the politicians themselves haven't really been talking about the solutions right now because it's such a close election and they're both going negative. You see all these negative ads. You don't see either candidate really talking about what they're going to do right now to solve all the problems in the city because they're both so busy fighting each other.
Beth Ferdig is WNYC's political reporter. Show them the money and use good intelligence for pinpoint strikes. That, in short, is the way to win in Afghanistan and smash the Al-Qaeda terrorist network, says hard-headed realist John Mearsheimer. He's a West Point grad, a keen military strategist, and a political scientist who says it's time to stop bombing and start bribing and building. And never mind a ground war. Mearsheimer says clever diplomacy and first-rate intelligence are our best weapons in the war on terror. Do you agree, or do you think it's time to send in the ground troops? You can join our conversation this evening at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is John Mearsheimer. He's a political science professor and co-director of the Program on International Security at the University of Chicago. He's written extensively on security issues. His new book is The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. He joins us from Chicago. Welcome, Professor John Mearsheimer.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for being here tonight. Also with us from Vermont Public Radio is our news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, John.
Hello, Jack.
So here's the situation. The war is not going so terribly well. It's not moving along as quickly as people earlier on expected. And there are suddenly, in the last week, calls for a ground war, for a major injection of U.S. ground troops in Afghanistan. Into the middle of that comes John Mearsheimer saying, no, bombing and ground war are both the wrong way to go. Why do you say that, Professor John Mearsheimer?
Well, first of all, we should make clear that the Bush administration itself has not endorsed the idea of a major commitment of American ground forces to the war up to this point. And there's no evidence that they're going to do that anytime soon. What they've decided to do is stick to their two-pronged strategy of using American aircraft to bomb the Taliban and relying on the Northern Alliance to provide the ground prong of the offensive.
We take your point that it's not part of any official program. On the other hand, we can all feel the pressure building. The Washington Post lead editorial on Sunday said the Bush administration should begin acting now to ensure it will be able to apply whatever military force is needed for victory. That's a pretty strong phrase.
Well, what's happening here is that as the bombing offensive shows less and less sign of succeeding, and the Northern Alliance shows few signs of being capable of launching a major ground offensive, pressure is building on us to put in our own ground forces to defeat the Taliban and possibly occupy all of Afghanistan. I think this would be a major mistake for a whole host of different reasons. I think that military force just does not promise much hope of winning this war against terrorism, especially winning the war in Afghanistan.
Well, let's look at each of the two paths. First, the bombing and then the ground war. You said that ground war would take 500,000 American troops. But before we even go there, what about the bombing? Have we reached its limits? Are we past the limits of its effectiveness already?
Well, I think that they're going to ramp up the bombing campaign a great deal more, for sure. I think it's highly unlikely that it'll succeed. The basic problem is that there are not good targets to hit in Afghanistan, and no way that you're likely to win this war strictly by bombing from the air. First of all, there are no high-value targets. This is a rather backwards and impoverished country, and therefore it's hard to see what you can hit on the ground to get them to throw up their hands and quit. So what we've basically ended up doing is going after frontline forces, the actual Taliban fighters who are dug in areas around Kabul and Mazar-e mm-hmm. Sharif. Mm-hmm. But the problem with attacking those forces is that, first of all, they're very hard to hit. They're dug in, and the forces can disperse to caves and better dug-in positions when the American bombers come overhead. Furthermore, bombing the Taliban solidifies the Taliban itself, right? There are fractures, there are mm-hmm. fissures inside the mm-hmm. Taliban, but by bombing them, you bring them together. And furthermore, all the evidence is that support for the Taliban within Afghanistan is increasing as a result of our bombing campaign. So it's hard to see how bombing from the air is going to bring the Taliban to its knees or even push it off the battlefield in meaningful ways. So but I would argue mm-hmm. that I would argue that even if you did that, mm-hmm. you push them into the cities, what are you going to do then? Bomb the cities?
To bits, and then what's left to pick up, and what happens to public opinion as you move forward. All of this...
That's exactly right.
All of this is what apparently is leading some people to call for much stronger action on the ground. We had William Kristol on last week, conservative editor in Washington. Senator John McCain is talking about stronger ground action, even the ground action, and even the Washington Post, as we heard. What about it? What would it take for U.S. forces to be effective on the ground in Afghanistan in reaching the U.S. goals?
Well, first of all, there would be huge problems getting in there. Afghanistan is a landlocked country, and you'd have to move mechanized infantry and armored forces in. You'd have to move heavy equipment in because that's what gives us our advantage in a fight. The last thing you want is a fair fight between the Taliban and U.S. soldiers. And the question is, how do you get heavy forces into Afghanistan? Do you move them through Pakistan? That's highly unlikely. Do you move them through Russia and Uzbekistan? That's highly unlikely. But even if you can solve the logistical problem and you can get large-scale American forces in there, you then run into the question of what kind of war you're going to end up fighting. It's highly unlikely that the Taliban would be willing to fight a conventional war because they would lose decisively. It's much more likely that they would retreat to the mountains and to the bad terrain, and they'd launch a guerrilla resistance, much like they did against the Soviets between 1979 and 1989. The terrain is ideally suited for a guerrilla war. They're experienced at fighting guerrilla wars. We have very little experience. Furthermore, to win that war, as to win any guerrilla war, you'd have to behave in a rather barbaric fashion. Guerrilla wars are really nasty fights. The end result of the United States using barbaric tactics is that we'd solidify further the support for the Taliban, and we do much to erode our position around the world at a point when we really need support mm-hmm. in the Arab and Islamic world. Mm-hmm. Then let's assume that none of this happens and we go in there and we win a victory. And mm-hmm. we then in a situation where we have to occupy Afghanistan for a long period of time. This is a country that's four times the size of Vietnam, 13 times the size of Bosnia, and 60 times the size of Kosovo. You're going to need at least 500,000 troops to occupy that place and keep order.
John Mearsheimer, you're scaring us right there. Hang on, we're going to go to a break for a second here, but before we go, and we'll come back to your formula for how we ought to proceed, but Jack Beatty, looking at these military options, they don't look too good as John Mearsheimer describes them.
No, they don't. And John's warning coincides with one from Sir Michael Howard, the British military historian, who argues right along the same lines in a recent piece in London Papers. And he basically does an analogy with Black Sunday, the terrorist incident in 1972, where the British, with just a few shots, killed some Irish civilians. And he said, if so much harm can be done by rifle fire, what is one to say about bombing? Of course, Black Sunday is a propaganda blow from which the British have yet to recover. And he argues precisely that these sorts of devices work against the end we're seeking, which is security for Americans.
We're talking about the limits potentially of military power in pursuing this war on terrorism. Do you believe in the effectiveness of the air war? Are you ready for ground war? Or can we buy and spy our way to victory? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, or you can read John Mearsheimer's recent editorial, Guns Won't Win the Afghan War, at our website. Log on to WBUR.org, click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. There's frustration with the pace of the U.S. air campaign over Afghanistan. There's increasing talk of a ground war of U.S. troops in numbers on the ground in Afghanistan to pursue the war. Professor John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago, a West Point grad, a military strategist, a political scientist, said neither military path is the way to victory. He's got a formula that depends more on money, spreading it around, and on good intelligence. But what do you think? We're thinking outside the box tonight. How would you pursue this war? Is there a better way than we're pursuing it right now, or are you ready to send in the troops? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Professor John Mearsheimer, you've described your view of the difficulties and pitfalls of both the air campaign and a significant U.S. ground presence, but we have to do something. How would you pursue this war on terror?
Well, first of all, with regard to the Taliban, I would emphasize clever diplomacy. I'd go to great lengths to try and split the Taliban up. There's no question that this is an area where there's a rich history of different components of coalitions switching sides as a result of bribery, a result of carrots of another sort, and sticks as well. So what I'd do is try and sow dissension within the Taliban and split it. Very importantly, I'd use Pakistan in that effort. Pakistan has significant influence in this region. In fact, Pakistan is largely responsible for building the Taliban. I'd go to great lengths to get the Pakistanis to try and help us to split the Taliban, remove it from power, and then create some sort of successor government that is basically friendly to the United States. And if that government includes some elements of the Taliban, more moderate elements, so be it. But the important point is just to get a government in place that's not supportive of Al-Qaeda and is not willing to put in support for further terrorist organizations.
But I guess a lot of people must be assuming that the U.S. government is already trying to use intelligence to split the Taliban. Is splitting it through good intelligence somehow incompatible with a military campaign? Can't
yes,
we do both?
It is. No, because bombing solidifies the Taliban, as I said earlier, and solidifies support inside Afghanistan for the Taliban. I think it would have been much wiser if the Bush administration were interested in using military force to wait until next spring and spend this month and the next couple months trying to employ clever diplomacy and working with the Pakistanis to split the Taliban. But once you go to war against the Taliban and in effect go to war against Afghanistan, I think it's going to be very hard to break the Taliban apart with clever diplomacy at the same time you're bombing.
You've talked about using money, using dollars to leverage those points of weakness in the Taliban. How exactly would you do that? What do you mean?
Well, the United States is a very rich country, and there's no reason that they couldn't pay different groups to switch sides. This has been done often in the past in this region. It's widely talked about. It's not some sort of brilliant idea on my part, I'm sad to say. And I think there's no reason that we couldn't use money and again, clever diplomacy to tear apart the Taliban. But that wouldn't solve the key problem. The key problem is getting Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, removing the Taliban from power is just a step in the right direction, but we have to get Al-Qaeda. And there, I would rely heavily on intelligence, our own intelligence, and buying intelligence from states in the region to help understand and locate the Al-Qaeda network and then destroy it.
Now, all the signs are that you can't just buy off Al-Qaeda, that you're going to have some force at some point. Don't you agree?
Oh, I agree completely. I'm saying you can use money to buy intelligence from others, and you can use your own money to build your own intelligence capabilities. But there's no question that you're then going to have to go in and get bin Laden et al. And that's going to require covert actions and selective military strikes, maybe involving air power, Ranger or Delta teams. I'm not against using military force. I wouldn't be against using massive military force if I thought it could produce the desired outcome at some reasonable cost. But the problem in this particular case is that it's hard to see how using massive military force doesn't backfire on you. And that's why I would rely on clever diplomacy to get the Taliban and intelligence and selective military strikes to get al-Qaeda.
Jack Beatty, there's an awful lot of momentum behind the military approach right now in Washington. Do you see any indication that Washington might, in fact, consider a change of gears, maybe as Professor Mearsheimer suggested, use Ramadan as a moment to stop bombing and shift directions here?
Well, I don't know. I think there's probably a resistance. John would be able to comment on this better than I could. But I sense that there's a resistance within the military to this sort of thing, to a big ground war there, precisely because they know what John was just outlining. The sheer that nature of the challenge there is not well adapted to the means we have at hand, and we would just simply have the enemy there isn't going to concentrate conveniently for us so that we can obliterate them. They're going to disperse, and once they disperse, we have a sort of Vietnam scenario, and we've been down that road before. What I'm afraid of is what we've seen in domestic matters recently with the Bush administration, that the president has gone back to his right in order to essentially keep the right quiet. He's done this on airport security, where he's rejected the idea of federalizing the guards, and he's done it on the stimulus package, where he's essentially embraced a House program to cut taxes for the wealthy and for corporations. And that frightens me, because if he does the same thing on the war to buy off his right wing, then I think we could be in real, real trouble. His father thinks, and I think others do, that he lost the 1992 election because he didn't care for – because the right rebelled. Pat Buchanan rebelled. Of course, other people think he lost the election because he was out of touch with the American people, such that Bill Clinton could say, "I feel your pain," and lots of people could say, "Yeah, you do."
But Jack, do you think that means that Bush is going to be more committed to the military approach, that move to the right, that embrace of the right?
I just don't know. I fear it. I fear the ground war scenario as meeting the pressure from the right, and I fear the expansion of the war beyond Afghanistan to Iraq as pressure from the right. And as I say, for George Bush, the main political fear is to the right. He thought it destroyed his father. He's not going to let it happen to him.
John Mearsheimer and Jack Beatty, we have an incredible number of callers who want to join this conversation. We're looking for solutions. We're looking for the best way to prosecute the war on terror. Professor John Mearsheimer suggests that the military options paths opened up so far, that is air war and the talk of a ground war, will not be effective, that diplomacy, money, and pinpoint strikes based on good intelligence are the way to go. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ayaz is on the line. Welcome, Ayaz.
Good evening. Thank you.
Sure.
I could not agree more with the professor. I grew up in Karachi during the invasion of Soviet Union over 10 years.
In Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. And there was definitely sympathy for the Soviets, believe it or not, even in Pakistan, before the invasion. And if there was any support for the Soviets in Pakistan, and there was, as I experienced it, completely eroded because of the occupation of Afghanistan.
But Ayaz, you can see the U.S. wants to do something. Do you agree that we can really pick this problem apart with money and good intelligence?
Good intelligence, absolutely. I think that even before this is the whole concept of the big boys and, you know, the big bully coming in and pounding this poor nation. You can't believe how much damage is being done to our image as Americans. It's painful for me to see it. And I can only tell you by experience, and, you know, we need all rational arguments and discussions about these things, but it's just not what plays well internationally and in areas that are so impoverished that, you know, having seen it myself, we can't even imagine as Americans. And now they view us as guys sending these technically advanced, you know, wizardry bombing done. It's just not what serves our national interest in the long term. That's why I agree with the professor that intelligence is where we could have won this war even before we started bombing.
Thanks for your call and your firsthand impressions from the front. I guess, Professor John Mearsheimer, this is exactly what you're concerned about. Ayaz's observation that it's turning people not only in Afghanistan but in the region sour on the United States.
Well, I think if you're going to win the war against terrorism, you have to dry up the sea that the terrorists swim in, which is to say that you have to win friends among the various states in the Arab and Islamic world. And furthermore, you have to go to great lengths to make sure that you don't create more terrorists, more recruits for al-Qaeda. And I think by launching a massive bombing campaign that lasts many months, if not a few years, you're likely to increase the number of states that are willing to countenance terrorists on their territory. And furthermore, you're going to create lots more terrorists and just make this problem a lot more worse.
You've said that if the U.S. goes in on the ground, it would have to employ brutal tactics. Why is that? Why would that be necessary?
Because that's basically the way guerrilla wars are fought. In Vietnam, the United States had a program called the Phoenix Program, where we went around and assassinated large numbers of Viet Cong for the purposes of eliminating the Viet Cong. I mean, guerrilla wars are not traditional wars where large armies stand out in the open and fight against each other. It's done in the shadows. It's done in very covert kinds of ways. And inevitably, large numbers of people get killed because it's hard to discriminate between civilians and guerrillas. And the end result is that the population turns against you. And furthermore, you lose diplomatic support around the world and in the United States. So it would be a total disaster, in my opinion, to get engaged in a guerrilla war in Afghanistan, as the Soviets found out in the 1980s.
We're talking about the potential limits of military power in solving our problem in Afghanistan, in pursuing the war on terror. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're thinking outside the box with military strategist John Mearsheimer. How would you pursue this war? Is there a better way? Josh is calling from New Kingsville, Ohio. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are you doing today?
We're well, thanks. What's your comment or question?
Actually, I personally think the gentleman that you're speaking to sounds to me like someone that is trying to just spend more tax money that we don't have. And my question to him is, why is it that if diplomatic policy and stuff is supposed to be able to work like he's suggesting we do, it didn't work for the last 8 years that Bill Clinton was in office trying to get people like Osama bin Laden and things like that? If diplomatic policy works, why didn't we already have it?
It's a good question. We'll put it right to him. Thank you, Josh. John Mearsheimer?
Yeah, there's two good questions in there. One, with regard to the fact that we'd have to spend tax money to bribe these folks, you're actually talking about incredibly small amounts of money compared to the amount of money we're spending on this war. So you could buy off parts of the Taliban at a very, very cheap price. That's not a serious issue. With regard to the Clinton administration and what they did over the past decade, the Clinton administration was deeply interested in getting the Taliban to cough up al-Qaeda. The Clinton administration understood what a serious problem that bin Laden presented. The problem was that they could not convince the Taliban to turn over bin Laden, and they tried very hard. They just couldn't do it. They did not, however, try to split apart the Taliban. See, my argument is that what we should try to do is split apart the Taliban, put our crosshairs on the Taliban. I don't want to be soft on the Taliban, but I'm saying that the best way to break them up is to do it in a clever and sophisticated way. The Clinton administration never tried that, and it wasn't their fault. The fact of the matter is that September 11th happened after they left office, and that galvanized this country to act in ways that it never could have acted in the 1990s when they were in power.
But you can hear in Josh's call the sentiment, the thought that the military solution ought to be sort of a simpler, quick and dirty, let's not mess around with diplomacy, let's go in militarily.
Well, it sounds good. But when you begin to look at it carefully and you begin to examine the question of how one can use military force to produce the desired outcome, it does not look like a pretty picture. I wish that Josh were right, that we could just simply take our military forces over there, much like we did in the Gulf in the 1990-91 period, and push the Taliban back, defeat them, and get rid of al-Qaeda, you know, in a couple weeks, and that would be the end of the story. But if you look carefully at what our options are militarily, they're not very attractive.
We're talking about our military options, our diplomatic options, and maybe the option of buying off enough of the Taliban to break it up and go after Osama bin Laden. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Jay is on the line. Welcome, Jay.
Good evening, Tom.
Hi.
I agree with the professor buying everybody else in the area. And as they started in the beginning, easing the sanction against Pakistan and India, but they came to short to ease sanction against Iran, with which they have 2.5 Afghani as a refugee living right there and standing in the board to get in.
Millions.
So therefore, in fact, that I think Colin Powell tried very hard to argue this point, but apparently he was not successful. As Professor probably remember, in the beginning, President Khatami immediately denounced the terrorism, and in fact, that on the public prayer, they stopped shouting that to America anymore. But that was a sign. But the U.S. administration came to short to do this. But after you start bombing, it will be very difficult to buy everybody because they have that anger. And another point, Professor, I would like your opinion on this. Because in the region, I was born in Iran, but I've been living here in the past 25 years. What happens is, though, they're talking about Taliban, asking Taliban to give up Osama bin Laden, but I think it would be easy to ask Osama bin Laden to bring to us Mullah Omar, which is the leader of Taliban. It would be much easier for him to bring in Taliban leader to us than the Taliban Osama bin Laden.
Jay, let's put these to John Mearsheimer. And the first is it too late for money? Once the bombs drop, can you still put the financial resources to work to break apart the Taliban?
Well, I think that you have to stop the bombing campaign, and that's why I suggested doing that with the Ramadan holiday that's coming up
10 days from now,
middle of this month. Mm-hmm. Yes, so you have to stop the bombing campaign, and then you'll have to repair some of the damage that's been done to this approach as a result of bombing. But I don't think it's too late. It's going to take time to deal with this problem. This is not something you can do overnight. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think everybody understands that this is a long conflict, and what we need is patience and tenacity. But the problem that we face is that we've committed ourselves to using military force, and I think as Jack correctly pointed out before, it's very hard to see, given the pressure that Bush is surely getting from the right, how he can back off from using military force. He may not introduce ground forces, but I think it's almost axiomatic that he's going to ramp up the bombing campaign, and that's going to have very negative consequences unless he's able to pull a rabbit out of his sleeve.
Jack, what about that? Apart from the Bush turn to the right that you described, do you see in the U.S. public a readiness to support a more subtle response, or do Americans want to see, you know, big airplanes dropping bombs?
That's a good question. I don't know. I haven't seen any polling on different strategies. I mean, this program is one of the first times I've ever heard an alternative strategy laid out. Mm. So I think that our debates are always taking place. It's like the range of Katharine Hepburn's acting, all the way from A to B. I mean, our debates about the war have just been very narrow, and we haven't heard of this third option. And we haven't heard the logic of this. The Democrats have not played on the war the part of loyal opposition. They've just played the part of loyal. And when the two parties agree on something, especially in foreign policy, it can often be a disaster. Because you don't get the internal corrections to bad policy.
Well, we're trying. We are the corrections. We're mixing it up tonight, looking at the limits, the possibilities, the options of military action in Afghanistan. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the limits of the effectiveness of military action in Afghanistan and if there might be a better way. Professor John Mearsheimer says there is. He's co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago, a military strategist, a political scientist, a West Point grad who served in the Air Force. He says instead we should use money to break apart the Taliban, to buy it to pieces, and we should use intelligence to find and apply pinpoint strikes to al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Do you think that can work, or are you ready to step up the bombing and go to ground war, which may be the path we're on? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. John Mearsheimer, you raise a really striking and a little unnerving thought in your writing on this front, that if the United States does get more involved on the ground, that it runs the risk of getting entangled, in not in a positive way, with China and Iran. Both border Afghanistan, and you point out that both may have interest, that while they're making friendly noises with the U.S. at the moment, if we get real tangled up on the ground, they might not be so helpful. What do you mean or fear there?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the United States has had very bad relations with Iran since 1979, and the Bush administration came into office arguing that what we should do is confront China, not cooperate with it. So the Chinese and the Iranians are deeply suspicious of the United States. If the United States went into Afghanistan with massive military forces, it would be right on the border of China and Iran, and this would cause great suspicion on their part. If the United States went into Afghanistan and won a quick and decisive victory, right? Mm. Then those countries would fear, especially Iran, that the United States might turn its crosshairs on them. So they're going to be very nervous about an American presence, and they're going to have powerful incentives to maybe think about helping the Taliban, as crazy as that may seem.
So potentially actively obstructionist to the U.S. effort, potentially.
Sure. And furthermore, with regard to China, if you have a beef to pick with the United States over Taiwan, what better way to deal with that problem than to get the United States bogged down in a major war in Central Asia so that it can't focus any of its precious resources or a few of its precious resources on Taiwan.
Let's turn to the phones. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mark is on the line. Welcome, Mark.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Question the resilience of Afghan guerrillas against the United States, because historically guerrilla forces prevailed against organized states only when they themselves were backed by a state, like Viet Cong was backed by the Union. Mujahideen in Afghanistan were backed by the United States. In each case, the backer constantly replaced the weapons, provided money, etc.
Got it. Mark, we've got a little bit of a difficult line with you, and I'm sorry for that, but we appreciate your point. And let's put it to Professor John Mearsheimer. Mark is pointing out that there's no major backer that's obvious of the Taliban against the United States, though you've just pointed out it could be Iran or China, yet that they're clearly not ready to leap into that role. If there's not a major backer of the Taliban, could they really succeed in a guerrilla war against the U.S.?
Well, I think it would be more difficult for them to succeed if they had no backing. I think they're going to get a lot of backing, and I think it's going to come through Pakistan. I mean, what you already see happening is large numbers of Pakistanis and freedom fighters.
Thousands going over, yeah.
Yes. In fact, the leader of the Taliban, Omar, has said, please don't come in such large numbers. We can't absorb all of you. So I think they'll get the weapons. And as you know, when you're fighting a guerrilla war, you don't need tanks and artillery pieces and aircraft. You can get by on rather simple and primitive weapons. But let's assume that I'm wrong and that Mark is correct and that we fight this guerrilla war and eventually win it. The question is, where does that leave us? First of all, I think we would erode what support we have in the world today and what support we have in Afghanistan today by how we wage that war. It would be a nasty war, and we'd win it at a real price. And furthermore, what would we do then? We'd have to occupy the country. Do you want to occupy Afghanistan with 500,000 plus troops forever? I mean, we went into Bosnia and Kosovo, said we'd be there for a short period of time, and then we'd have the troops home. We're still there. why wouldn't we stay in Afghanistan for a commensurate period of time? I think this is just something the United States wants to avoid.
But if we tried it, it doesn't make good strategic sense. Yeah. But if we did try it, and there are voices that are being raised to say go for it, in your view as a military analyst, how long would that take?
I think it would probably take, you know, somewhere on the order of 3, 4, 5 years if we were lucky. And as I say, we would have to behave in a quite heavy-handed way to pull that off. And it would require a large number of forces because you'd have to go root out the guerrillas and kill them.
And if we don't want to do that, if we don't want to do that, we want to rely on the Northern Alliance as the ground force. Do you see them as an effective substitute for U.S. troops?
No, not at all. I mean, I think there's almost overwhelming consensus on that point. First of all, the Northern Alliance is outnumbered by the Taliban by about 3-1. Secondly, the Northern Alliance is very poorly trained, poorly equipped, and poorly led. And they constantly talk about all these offensives they're going to launch to capture Kabul or to capture Mazar-e-Sharif, and they never seem to do that. And the winter's coming now, and I think we're going to make it through the winter without them achieving those goals. But let's assume that I'm wrong there, that we're able to train them up to the point where they're a rather formidable fighting force. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is they're not capable of taking over all of Afghanistan for two reasons. One, there's just not enough of them, and two, they're deeply hated in the central and southern parts of the country because of their behavior in the past. So if they begin to move south in a successful military fashion, the locals are likely to rise up and try to fight them at every point for fear that the heathens will be coming back again. So it's very hard to see how the Northern Alliance can substitute for a large U.S. military presence for the purposes of conquering this entire country.
John Mearsheimer, you paint a vivid picture and you give us a lot to think about, almost too much, but we're taking it on board. We'll work with it. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome, Tom.
John Mearsheimer is co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. He's author of the new book, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. He graduated from West Point in 1970 and served 5 years as an officer in the U.S. Air Force. Jack Beatty, you hear the picture that John Mearsheimer's painting there. How do those perceptions from someone who studied this closely intersect with the conversation in Washington?
I don't know. I'm wondering if perhaps they may intersect through the military. I mean, people who are really practical about these matters and who don't let, you know, political flatus get in their way, who actually say, wait a minute, what will work here? And apparently there's a whole body of scholarship, John's colleagues at Chicago, about how this is done in civil war, in guerrilla situations. And it's retail war. You know, you buy them off, you get intelligence. And this business of hearts and minds, it's not just about, you know, being good to people. It's about getting intelligence. It's instrumental to the way you fight the war. So maybe the military is saying some of this, but I tell you, the guerrilla war there would be a fearsome prospect. In the 80s, I had a cab driver in D.C. He was a former physician in Kabul. He said the Soviets brought in 20 dead men one day, and they were all shot in the left eye. And they said, how did the Afghans get so close to administer this coup de grace? And the fellow said, no, that wasn't a coup de grace. Those were rifle shots.
Oh. That's sharp shooting. Well, let's hope that maybe some of this thinking is in fact going on, maybe part of what's planned right now. Jack, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, turning a profit in a time of terror, economists and traders expect the Federal Reserve to slash interest rates tomorrow for the 10th time this year in an effort to pull the U.S. out of a recession. But as special coverage correspondent Jonathan Salzman reports, some industries are adjusting to new realities and some are reaping gains.
For most Americans, the economic news since September 11th has been unremittingly grim.
Topping the business headlines, the number of layoff announcements continued at a strong pace in the wake of the September 11th terrorist strikes.
Not everyone is reeling from the aftershocks of the terrorist attacks. A few business people say they've benefited from the sense of unease gripping America.
It's easy to say that September was by far the best September in gross sales that we've ever had since 1978. And it was one of the best months we've ever had.
Sandy Kane owns a gun shop in North Kingstown, Rhode Island. Surrounded by wood and glass cabinets that display hundreds of gleaming new and antique guns, the 54-year-old businessman says sales are up at least 30% in the past 2 months. Many of his customers are first-time gun buyers who feel acutely vulnerable since the terrorist strikes.
Obviously, they're realistic enough not to worry about terrorists marching up their driveway and having to defend themselves against those terrorists. But what it has done is heightened their awareness of what we call the bad guys that are in our society and have been in our society for as long as we've been a country.
Customers are buying a wide range of items at Kane's three-room shop, from powerful AK-47-style rifles to Civil War-era firearms that fetch thousands of dollars and seem a good investment, particularly in precarious times. But Kane's hottest-selling items are .38 and .357 caliber revolvers.
We've had women who are coming in and buying them, women in their middle-aged women, older women, younger women, couples, people who've never owned firearms. And the revolver is something that we highly recommend.
Kane, one of several gun dealers in Rhode Island and Massachusetts to report brisk sales, says some of his customers have expressed apocalyptic fears.
They have a concern that if there is a major catastrophe in the country, the haves may be pitted against the have-nots, and if there's a shortage of everything due to some major conflagration, they would need some kind of protection against the have-nots trying to take something away from them.
Do you think that's a realistic fear?
I don't think it's too realistic, no.
But it's good for your business.
Obviously, it's good for business.
While some Americans are trying to comfort themselves by buying guns, others are turning to knives, specifically those wielded by cosmetic surgeons. In an unexpected development since September 11th, cosmetic surgeons around the country report that office procedures like eye lifts and collagen injections have increased 20% to 30% over the same period last year. Lyda Snow is a spokeswoman for the American Society for Aesthetic Plastic Surgery.
We're hearing that some people are reacting with a feeling of, if not now, then when? If they were in a relationship and they were considering getting married, they've often decided to push up their plans. If they decided that they had some sort of a dream thing that they always wanted to do, they've decided to put that on their schedules. And if they had been considering cosmetic surgery, they are now saying, if I don't do something for myself now, then when will I do it?
One of those people is Sheila Lurvy, a medical transcriptionist in Huntington Beach, California. On September 12th, she had a lower facelift and neck lift and wrinkles removed from around her mouth and eyes. It cost nearly $15,000, but she didn't consider it frivolous.
I thought it was frivolous before, but then on the 11th, I watched TV all day and seeing what was happening, I realized I could be dead in an instant, and I wanted this more than ever. I realized that I didn't want to live my life not being happy with the way I looked.
Not surprisingly, many defense contractors are gearing up for increased demand by the military. They include Raytheon, which makes long-range weapons, and Northrop Grumman, which makes surveillance systems. But here, too, the beneficiaries also include less obvious companies. For example, Malden Mills, the Lawrence, Massachusetts company that produces fleece fabrics, is making black and olive-colored jackets for the Army and Marines involved in the ground troop action in Afghanistan. Business had been down for Malden Mills this year. Nonetheless, David Costello, the director of sales and marketing, is hesitant to call the increase in orders from the military good news.
The fact of everything that happened on September 11th, if we're going to realize an increase in orders, we'll absolutely step up and meet that demand. But we certainly don't consider it good news that we're getting more business considering what happened on September 11th.
Of course, most American businesses have been hit hard by the economic downturn. To soften the blow, these firms are also catering to jittery customers. Take Boston Coach. The upscale car service had to lay off 194 workers, or 13% of its staff, after business plunged 70% immediately after the attacks. To recover some of the reduced demand for rides to and from airports, the company recently began offering door-to-door service between cities. Afraid to fly from Boston to New York? Boston Coach will take you in a Lincoln Town Car for $349. Back at the gun shop in North Kingstown, Sandy Kane says he'd obviously prefer that his business be doing well and that the terrorist strikes never happened. But they did happen, and customers are flocking to his store.
I would say if you're in the firearms business and you haven't seen an increase in sales, then something is wrong with the way you operate your business.
For Special Coverage, I'm Jonathan Saltzman.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.